the Senate Committee on Health Policy, March 16, 2005. And let's go ahead and start, since Bates isn't here. Oh, Bates is here. All right, Senator Bates. Let's go ahead and start with Senate Bill 601. Okay, I am opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 601. And I am opening a subcommittee since there's just two of us. Okay, Senator, yes. I would also like to introduce Corey Roberts. He's from the American French School in Portland, and he is shadowing me, and he'll be leaving about the middle of the meeting, so when he scoots out, it isn't because he doesn't like what's going on. Okay. Welcome, Corey. All right. I'm opening a public hearing on 601, and do you want to describe the bill, or should Senator Bates?
I will briefly describe it, Senator. Thank you, and Senator Bates, I'm sure, can do a much better job. This bill does prohibit providers whose revenues include state monies from billing local correctional facilities an amount that exceeds certain statutory rates as payments for hospital services and as payments for other medical services. It applies provisions to medical services provided to an individual in custody of a local correction facility on or after the effective date of this bill, declares an emergency effective upon passage. Thank you, Senator.
Okay. Senator Bates?
Madam Chair, could I say something?
Yes, Senator Morris.
I just want to say that we're doing double duty right now in the Education Committee and in this committee because the education people are leaving in a few minutes and we're trying to pass bills out of both. Senator Cruz and I are in both committees. I will be gone for a few minutes and then I'll be back. This is a good time to leave.
It's an excellent time to leave, Senator. Madam Chair, Corey, bonjour. Remind me of a senator we have serving with us now. He looks about like you. He's the revenue chair. I don't think he's any older than you are, but that's okay. This is a simple bill brought to me actually by a constituent in my local area, and it was brought forward to me also by the counties, and that the counties feel that they are being placed in a position where they have to pay at the highest possible rate when...
Please.
When they have an inmate that goes to a hospital, basically, and they'd ask that they be relieved of this burden and that they pay a rate that is commensurate with a Medicare rate, which is a basic standard used across the state for lots of rate setting. There are multiple rates that hospitals use for commercial, non-commercial, OHP. It's a very complex system, but we chose the Medicare rate as probably the fairest and simplest one to use.
Medicare,
not Medicaid. Okay. This bill, in a very simple term, says that the hospitals will charge the counties when they have an inmate come into their jurisdiction a Medicare rate, and doesn't say anything more than that or anything less than that. I think that there would be some cost to hospitals, and we all know what hospital cost shifting is about. We also know hospitals are doing reasonably well in the state, but that our counties are really in rather desperate straits as far as finance is concerned because of the recent revenue cuts we've had and had to pass on to them. So although I think it's a reasonable bill, one we should consider and pass, I would be open to any amendments that others might want to make for it. But basically it lays out a very simple program of paying Medicare rates for inmates going to hospital settings.
Yes, Senator Corton.
Chairman Anderson, thank you. Senator Bates, is this 1145? Is that what we're dealing with here?
It could affect 1145 from the point of view that 1145, embedded in 1145 costs are costs involved with health care for those inmates. It's not a large part of 1145, it's a cost of 1145. It's a very small piece of 1145, but it lowers the county cost for hospitalized care. When an individual's in the custody of the
county...
Can
you explain 1145?
1145 is a transfer program between the state and county for keeping local offenders in county jails under certain conditions. It's considered a more cost-effective way of dealing with these offenders. It's also probably a better wavelength with those offenders, as they don't go to large prison institutions. They're dealt with on a local basis. They usually are in for less than a year, and they can get help there on a remedial basis to keep them from reoffending. It's a program that was put together, I think, 7 or 8, 9 years ago, but what has become somewhat in jeopardy because we have not been able to fund it as fully as we had in the past. At least two counties have opted out of that, which means the state has to pick up the cost of those offenders. Most of the counties have still stayed in it. This takes a very small amount of pressure off the counties, but it's significant from the point of view that it does take some pressure off. Hope that answers your question. 1145 was the bill that set the program up, and we commonly refer to it as 1145.
Okay. Now, Chair, 1145 yes. was passed in the 95 session and perfected in a special session 96. It says if you are sentenced to a year or less for a violation of a state criminal statute, rather than go to one of the state facilities, you will go to a county facility. So that is what it's all about. And we've been laboring for some time since then in terms of properly funding it. So as soon as I saw a local correctional facility, I wondered if this is another part of 1145. That's exactly what
it is. It is from that point of view. Also, we pointed out that if you're an inmate in these facilities, and you happen to be on the Oregon Health Plan, you immediately are off any federal benefit at that point because you're an inmate, so that match funds can't be used for these people. In other words, the county has to pay the full bore and can't access Medicaid funds at all.
And what kind of difference are we talking? Site of procedure?
It would vary from hospital to hospital and setting to setting, but generally speaking, we're probably looking at a 25% discount in that neighborhood. But it would vary tremendously from hospital to hospital and what relationships exist between them and the counties.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Bates, we have two other bills that you're going to speak on. Could I just close this so that we don't have to keep coming and getting you, or would you rather have us come get you?
I believe that the other bills and the people who want to speak to those bills have a right to do so with me there, and I think it would be difficult for them, and as a courtesy to them, I'll come down for both those bills when they come up.
Thank you.
The public has a right here, and I don't think just because we happen to be members of the Senate or the House, we have any special rights. Going first is more than we deserve at times. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Bate. All right. I would like to call this one. Paul Snyder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Paul Snyder, and I'm here representing the Association of Oregon Counties in support of Senate Bill 601. We appreciate the effort that Senator Bates has made to help us with dealing with a cost that is spiraling and continues to grow significantly over time. I can tell the committee that we checked with a couple of counties with respect to these costs a few months ago, and I can't tell you whether or not they're typical, but I can tell you that in Lane County, we checked with respect to medical cost increases for inmates over a period of about 4 years. They indicated that from 99 to 2000, that fiscal year growth was 22.1%. In 2001, 42.7%. In 01-02, 24.8%. And 02-03, there was no growth. But they did indicate that the flattening of the cost in that situation is due to closure of 19 beds, jail beds. An additional 84 jail beds were closed in fiscal year 03-04. Those are the financial circumstances with which we have to deal, and it's our hope that Senate Bill 601 would help us to deal with those costs.
Thank you. Questions? All right. Bruce Bishop.
This is one of our priorities.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, distinguished members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems this afternoon. We are not in support of Senate Bill 601 as drafted. The bill proposes to require local governments, counties, and cities to pay medical providers at Medicaid benchmark rates, but to pay hospitals at non-Medicaid, at Medicaid non-contract rates. So the bill actually provides a different payment standard for hospitals than would be applicable to other health care providers in this circumstance. And that's the reason for our objection to the bill. Last session, the Assembly decided to create a provision that established a differential in the Medicaid program between contract and non-contract rate payments. That was a very controversial section that was a part of House Bill 3624, became commonly known as Section 12 of House Bill 3624 that created the differential. That bill also created a benchmarking system that identified the basis on which Medicaid rates would be compared. For all providers except hospitals, Senate Bill 601 uses the benchmarking system as the payment guide. For hospitals, it takes the discounted non-contract rate, which is a substantial discount for Medicaid in Medicaid arrangements. We would recommend to the committee that instead of differentiating hospitals from other providers in that case, that ORS 414.741, the benchmarking standard, be used instead of the non-contract standard. That's the principal basis for our objection. However, we are also concerned that the bill fails to address an underlying problem. Some local governments appear to be shirking their responsibilities to pay for inmates' medical care. Recently, a member hospital asked the General Counsel for the Hospital Association for advice concerning discharge of patients from the hospital. A local correctional facility had complained to the hospital that they were not being notified when patients were being discharged. When the hospital took the position that it could not notify law enforcement because it would be a violation of patient confidentiality, the hospital learned that the law enforcement agency was furloughing its inmates to the hospital so that they could receive medical care that the county would not have to pay for. That arrangement may save local governments some money, but those costs are shifted onto others who pay hospital bills. And 601 doesn't address that problem. Subsection 4 of ORS 169-166, which is at lines 1 to 4 on page 2 of the bill, allows local correctional facilities to avoid financial responsibility for their inmates' medical care, quote, upon release of the individual from the actual physical custody of the local correctional facility, unquote. That's the provision that we believe should be amended, because it encourages counties and cities literally to dump their inmates at the hospital door so that they don't have to pay for the care. Yesterday, the Business and Economic Development Committee heard a bill about trying to protect nursing staff from violence in the hospital. This is exactly the kind of problem that this bill addresses. Inmates are being put in hospitals without knowledge of the hospitals, without knowledge of their staff, and without backup from law enforcement. This clearly puts hospital staff at risk and creates, the strong potential that there will be injuries to staff in that situation. At a minimum, we believe hospitals should be notified when inmates are being released to the hospital for care. Preferably, it seems to us, jails should maintain custody of their inmates even when they're inside the medical facility receiving care. We've proposed in the written testimony one solution, and that would be to add a new subsection to the bill that would specify that a local correctional facility that temporarily releases an individual from actual physical custody solely for the purpose of the individual's receiving medical care not provided by the city or county shall remain liable for payment for medical services provided to the individual. That at least attempts to address the problem of furloughing that some counties are engaged in so that they don't have to pay the bills. We have two objections to the bill, what the payment standard is and what the practices can be under the law. For those reasons, we would request that the committee not approve the bill in its current form. We would be happy to work with the committee and its sponsors on improving the bill. Thank you very much.
Questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Bishop. Senator Westland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Senator Ben Westland, District 27, Central Oregon. I am here to testify in strong support for Senate Bill 601. And I think perhaps my most important point is how this bill should be viewed and characterized. This is not a bill about avoiding financial responsibility. This is a bill that helps establish financial fairness and predictability for a significant purchaser of medical services, in this case, Department of Corrections, as it relates to our hospitals. There is nothing wrong with, obviously, the need for Department of Corrections to purchase those services, and certainly nothing the matter with the requirement for the hospitals to provide those services. But what is lacking is a standardized pricing, I don't want to say mechanism, but pricing equation that would allow a more predictable and, in my opinion, fair relationship between hospitals, particularly DRG hospitals, and Department of Corrections. There's nothing nefarious going on here. I mean, there's nothing underhanded has been going on. It's just a little bit like one of the largest companies purchasing health care from hospitals in a haphazard fashion. That's not the hospital's fault. It's not the DOC's fault. But this is a bill that brings a more rational approach for a purchaser of health care, in this case a state purchaser of health care, to the medical system. I would also like to point out, and I appreciate Mr. Bishop's willingness to work on this bill. I do believe there is significant middle ground here. Amendments should be coming forward, not only on the part of the hospitals to give some certainty to the hospitals. They have an equal argument in this discussion, but also as it relates to physicians. Physician rates and services are controlled with much more certainty, and as a generalization, pretty much as a rule, are paid at a lower reimbursement rate currently than our friends at the hospitals. That I'll cease my remarks and be happy to take any questions.
Yes, Senator Courtney.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Weston, what about this point about they just dropped off the door and therefore they conceivably could pose a risk to the staff? I don't know what the fact situation, but that is also in the written and the verbal testimony of the previous witness.
What I heard Mr. Bishop's representation of that, and I, quite frankly, I would not want to speak for him. I do not understand that point. There is patient dumping. I mean, that goes on. Certain hospitals are more impacted by that. I'm not so sure that our cities and counties and governmental entities are the most egregious offenders of that. And there is certainly a responsibility that the hospitals have to provide true, not just urgent, but true emergency care. but how big a problem that is and how specific it is, I think that's one of the issues that we need to work with Mr. Bishop on as we go forward on this bill.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Before you leave, I don't plan to move this. I don't plan to have a next a work session until I know that there's common ground with the hospitals and with the. So if you and Senator Bates and the counties and the hospital association could get together with some amendments, that would be great. And I will. See, no,
Chair,
yes.
If I could say, I appreciate those remarks very much, and I think as many times is the case in our process that bills, and indeed specifically this bill, does create the arena and the forum and the format from which we can generate much better public policy through good discourse, compromise, and discussion. So I appreciate your position. That is exactly the correct position, and I appreciate Mr. Bishop's words to that effect as well.
Great. Well, I would like to close the work session, the public hearing on 601. And while you're here, are you ready, prepared to talk about Senate Bill 883?
Briefly, Madam Chair.
Okay, then I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 883. And if someone could get Senator Bates. Oh, no, he's not on that one. Never mind.
Well, if
okay.
Bates isn't on it, I'm not on it. So,
so go ahead with describing to us what Senate Bill 883 does.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, Senator Ben Watson, District 27, here to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 883. What this bill does is it clears up a problem created by electronic transactions that can substantially increase our healthcare effectiveness and efficiencies. This bill can help bring more efficiencies out of our already sparse healthcare dollars. It's a bill that will financially incent claimants to do more of the proper filing, move away from paper records. I don't want to get off on a large diatribe about the need for electronic records and electronic transfer. This is a very costly and necessary endeavor that we will all, physicians, hospitals, states, insurance companies, have to go down eventually. But this specifically relates to how HIPAA has impacted electronic record filings with physicians and their insurance companies and payers. So it's really kind of a simple fix. It encourages what I call a common sense approach to claims and their electronic transactions. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I think that we'll call Barney State up, and you're welcome to stay or leave.
That's well said.
Yeah. Good thing or a bad thing?
I won't take it personally. For the record, Madam Chair, Barney Spate, Office of Medical Assistance Program, Department of Human Services. I appreciate the sponsorship of this bill for no other reason than to have some discussion about what I think is one of the near-term and perhaps easiest achievements we can make in the whole area of electronic health information. And I know this committee, this legislature, I just picked this up recently from Council of State Governments, upgrading healthcare information. A lot of talk, and appropriate talk, a lot of planning, new federal policies in the whole area of the electronic exchange of medical records and having offices, physicians' offices, hospitals, and others having electronic medical records so that they can move clinical information around between providers to improve the efficiency of healthcare delivery and the accuracy and help overcome any kind of mistakes that might occur because of written records. This really looks at a much more fundamental and basic business aspect of health, of the healthcare sector. It looks at claims transactions, how providers get paid. Several years ago, the federal government passed a bill, HIPAA. We probably, those of us in healthcare, primarily think of HIPAA because of its privacy. It was a major piece of legislation relative to the privacy of healthcare information. But within HIPAA, there was also laid out a national policy to move toward a standard electronic format for claims, eligibility, remittance advices. These are the things insurers send back to providers with their checks or payment. To really create a national language, a national electronic language, that everybody would have a transaction language that would be similar, and we would all be talking in that language. It's not unlike the metaphor I like to use in this is, decades ago, the banks decided about the language they would use to transmit information from ATMs to each other. This was an attempt by the federal government, and we're moving toward that. In Oregon, the Department of Human Services will be ready at the end of December of this year to be HIPAA compliant, to receive electronic claims in a standardized HIPAA-approved approach. In fact, currently, most recent information, about 70% of the claims that we process, and there's about 2 million claims a quarter, are already received electronically, but there's a standard, I don't want to get too technical, but there's a non-standard format that's still out there, and then there still are, in our agency, about 12% of the claims that are paper-based. They're received through the mail. They need to be hand-loaded into or data entry-loaded into the computer for processing. While this bill is not perfect, and if it needs work, I'd be happy to work with folks on it, the concepts in the bill, I think, are exactly the ones that, as a public policy in the state, we should articulate. The fundamental policy is that we want these basic claims transactions to be electronically based, not paper-based, and we want them to be compliant with, if you will, the HIPAA, the national electronic language, so to speak. Secondly, it does, I think, another fundamental principle is that someplace prospectively in the future, as providers move and get ready to submit claims on a HIPAA-compliant basis, they need some warning, they need some look down the road that there's a disincentive if they stay paper-based. And so one of the provisions that, as opposed to effectiveness immediately on passage, would be to think about an effective date that's in January of 2006 or July of 2006, a prospective date. Because in our agency, and I think most commercial carriers, are doing a lot of work with providers to incent them through education and through other techniques to use electronic claim submission and HIPAA-compliant claim submission. For example, in the Department of Human Services Office of Medical Assistance Program, we're actually saying if you set up and work with us on a HIPAA-compliant electronic, we will transfer the funds electronically. We'll do EFT funds transfers as opposed to generating checks. The advantages of all of this, one, from our point of view, the self-interest from the point of view of a claims payer, I'm speaking from a public agency point of view, I think it's also true in the private sector, is electronic claims processing is incredibly more efficient. For example, the magnitude of difference is about 10 cents to process a clean electronic claim over a dollar to process a paper claim, and sometimes it can be even more than a dollar. So there's at least, from an administrative efficiency point of view, there's a significant savings. And I guess I keep thinking if we can change the cost trends on the administrative side, that at least prepares us with a few more dollars for the healthcare side. There's a speedier turnaround. A clean claim arrived electronically in our offices can actually be paid in less than 7 days. And in some days, and sometimes it can be paid based upon the time of arrival within the same week that's it's received. The processing of paper claims takes a lot more time, and unfortunately we have a claims lag right now that I'm not very proud of. We're working in the right direction. But 30 days is not an uncommon lag time for a paper claim to be processed. And lastly, I indicated we're trying to use the incentive of electronic funds transfer so that the basically the provider not only gets quick turnaround, but they get immediately, they get immediate deposit in their bank, and then they receive a remittance advice electronically. So it closes the loop and takes a lot of the confusion out of moving paper around. The last part of the bill, which in some quarters may be controversial, and that is it basically permits, it is permissive, and I support the fact that it uses the term may, it permits a health insurer or a state health plan, and I think we have to work on some language about who this actually applies to, but it does permit a discount from the claim that's received, and in my mind it should be a discount if it's a paper claim, basically to recognize the higher cost of processing that claim, and really to be a longer term incentive to say that discount won't apply if you move to electronic claims processing and HIPAA, and more specifically HIPAA compliant. Another concept would be to even have some sort of tiered discounting, so that in say the first 12 months it would be relatively modest. Again, trying to work on an incentive side, but with an ultimate long-term disincentive, and then having perhaps in the second year it raised to a larger discount, always fixed at some max, and also always permissive, because each company, the intent of this would be to apply to both private sector and public sector claims processors. Each company may have a different approach of how they want to work with their provider community, and as I indicated, we are doing lots of education and outreach and helping folks get that way. We want to continue that, but at some point there may be a few providers out there that for whatever reason, and they may have some legitimate business reasons, if they submit on paper, it's actually going to cost us a whole lot more to process those. And I guess the question is, who should be bearing that additional cost? That's the general background of the bill, Madam Chair. I'd be happy to answer questions. I'd also be happy to work with any interested parties if there are improvements that can be made, some of which I suggested this afternoon.
Thank you. The reason I brought this forward is when I found out that you can do take care of an electronic billing in 3 to 5 days versus up to maybe 6 months for one that is not done electronic, and now that you've shared the cost, it's really something I think that the agency needs to really look at. And I would think providers to avoid HIPAA requirements have not gone electronic, and if we gave an incentive for them to go electronic so that they would actually be billed at a lower rate or higher,
you could describe this as a disincentive for using paper or alternative. It's neutral if you use electronic.
Yeah.
I think one of the concerns we have, I have to admit I'm not steeped in either the economics or the technology of this industry of the electronic claims processing, and they have clearinghouses that do this on behalf of providers. But there is a concern that whenever we, for example, say we will only accept an electronic, HIPAA-compliant electronic bill, currently we're receiving about 30% of those that are not HIPAA. If they don't convert to HIPAA compliance, their option would be to return to paper, and that would raise the number of paper claims that we have to process. And there's a certain irony there. We have a national standard. We have a national language. We're all ready to go. And for us to see the number of paper claims go up and the requisite staff that would have to be used to process those, our goal is to get the number of paper claims down to well under 1%, so that we get the efficiencies on the administrative side. And I think also the other that I'm told is that there's a much higher intervention of errors in electronic claims processing, because oftentimes between the provider and the clearinghouse they'll get blank fields or things worked out before the claim ever gets to the payer. So there's lots of business efficiency reasons to move in this direction.
Great. I'm looking forward to continue to work with you on
Thank
this.
You.
I certainly do not plan to do a work session in the near future until we really have the nuts and bolts taken care of. And let me call up Bruce Bishop and go ahead, Senator Westman.
Well, I was just going to make a general comment as well with regard to our providers. Many of them, we're all familiar with the issues reimbursement rates and not covering costs. And part of this is a incentive to help establish some electronic billing capabilities. It becomes a cash flow issue, and while that has some, shall I say, is not the major intent of the bill, at least from the state's standpoint, I think it does have positive spin-offs for some of our providers, particularly in rural areas with patient mixes that skew heavily to Medicaid and Medicare. And
great.
Thank you.
Mr. Bishop.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. We are generally in support of the principles in Senate Bill 883. As Mr. Spade indicated, there may be some technical issues that need to be addressed in the bill. Most hospitals have electronic billing systems in place now, but to make those systems work effectively, it's a two-way street, and the payers have to be prepared to receive and respond to those electronic billings. One of the problems that Mr. Spade's agency is dealing with now is catching up with the technology to be able to respond to those, as he indicated. And that's a process that's underway. It is not completed. For that reason, we think that this bill's proposal of some unspecified discount amount for non-electronic payments is probably unwarranted at this point. It may be a carrot or a stick, but we don't know if putting in a flat discount for non-electronic payments will actually accomplish the purpose of shifting people to those systems. It may just further compound problems that those on paper or who are required to use paper are experiencing. I haven't heard any testimony about what should be filled in the blank, and so I guess that's an item that we'll discuss further. The only other thing I would mention at this point, and I will first admit that I'm not expert either in HIPAA or in the state provisions that conform to HIPAA, but I think we need to be careful with the language that's in the bill that does track from current statute about health care providers, state health plans, or health insurers. I'm thinking particularly about the Public Employee Benefit Board and what its status would be under these requirements. That program obviously provides health benefits for state employees. As I read current Oregon law, I'm not sure that PEB is a health care provider, a state health plan, or a health insurer. Maybe it's picked up under one of those provisions, but I can't find where it is. So there may be some areas like that that we want to address as well to make sure that the language, you know, includes the actors that we think it should. This is a problem for hospitals. Hospitals would prefer to get payments not only from insurers but from the state as quickly as possible, and so we would like to do everything we can to encourage the state to bring its systems up to speed so that that can happen.
Thank you. Discussion. Senator Cruz.
Yeah, question for Senator Westland, and I'm sure I apologize for being late. We were trying to get Senator Walker out of committee in time to catch her bus to Pendleton, which we did. So my question for Senator Westland is, how in the world did you get me to sign on to these bills anyway?
Well, without specifically avoiding your question, Senator Cruz, I would just like to point out that I think the addition in the presence of the gentleman now on both the left and right side of the dais in the blue shirts have certainly increased not only the presence of the committee but also the physical appearance. So,
okay, I'll take that as a yes.
Is that a yes?
Okay, thank you. Hearing no further discussion and there is no one else, I will close a public hearing on Senate Bill 883, and I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 510. I'm going a little out of order because we would like to get some votes out. I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 510. I didn't mean to say work session. I'm sorry. Okay, please describe the bill.
Briefly, thank you, Senator. What this bill basically does is establishes that the current moratorium on building residential care facilities, basically assisted living centers or facilities or ELFs, does not apply to facilities that are not seeking to increase number of units or residents in a facility. It does extend the moratorium to 2009, requires applicants who are facing the pipeline to submit plans for new facilities before the moratorium went into effect and to pay an annual fee. We do have dash one amendments, which set the annual fee at $5,000, dash one amendments. On top of that, it does also establish that DHS, the current law which establishes the criteria for issuing licenses, is in effect. This act does not become effective until June 30th, 2005. And the section 5 of the bill does describe basically some transition effects depending on when the bill would or would not go into effect. And I will defer to the testifier to just describe that section in more detail. Also in the dash one amendments is additional language that would amend in that anybody with a plan in the pipeline would have to submit a copy of a construction permit. And basically this bill does stem from a 2001 session which we did put a moratorium on an assisted living facility, basically kind of because of the cost and the number of facilities that were coming online, basically, and not enough people to fill them. Thank you, Senator.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Bacobian. Would Jim Carlson please come up?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jim Carlson, representing the Oregon Healthcare Association. We're a private not-for-profit trade association that represents over 500 licensed long-term care providers. Speaking today in support of Senate Bill 510, which has, Mr. Bacobian has indicated, extends the existing licensing moratorium for assisted living facilities and residential care facilities for an additional 4 years. I believe you also have, in addition to testimony from myself, copies of letters from the Seniors and People with Disabilities Division and from the Oregon Housing Community Services Division in support of the legislation as well. The effect of the legislation is to extend the current moratorium until June 30th, 2009. The legislation was originally enacted by the legislature in 2001 and was extended again 2 years last session. The bill also addresses the issue of pending projects which were grandfathered in under the original legislation. And what occurred after 2001 and what the 2001 legislation provided for was that any projects that were, we kind of use the term, in the pipeline, that were in active development, were able to submit plans, and they were able to then be grandfathered in because the legislature did not intend to impact projects that were there. Well, you had a very large number of plans, quite frankly, a much larger number of plans filed at that time than any of us anticipated. And so some of the language in the bill, which I'll get into in more detail in a minute, seeks to address that, what we call pipeline issue. And then third, the bill makes a fairly minor technical correction in the existing statute just to clarify the law and that it does not apply to license renewals for existing facilities. We did have some attorneys over the last 2 years who were working with clients on some renewals who had called to our attention a conflict in the existing statute. The reason why the moratorium was needed initially and the why we're recommending extension of it was primarily what occurred over about a 10-year period between 1994 and 2004, when Oregon went from having 29 licensed assisted living facilities with a total capacity of about 1,600 units to today, where we have over 192 licensed facilities with total capacity of over 12,000 units. We saw a tremendous rapid growth occur during that 10-year period. I mean, literally to the point where there were a couple facilities opening a week during the course of time. During the same period of time, the total capacity for residential care facility units doubled. And the growth was fueled largely by two factors. One, which was a strong consumer demand for assisted living services. It was a relatively new care model and setting at that point in the early 90s, and it was extremely popular and has remained so with consumers, but also the demographic trends we're dealing with our aging population. This dramatic increase in the number of facilities created a number of challenging issues for us in our delivery system, which included overbuilding in many service areas, a lot of excess capacity being brought online, workforce shortages in communities, particularly when you get to some smaller rural communities or outlying service areas, having two or three new facilities open in a relatively short period of time was creating some real challenges there and stress on the workforce for both existing providers and new providers coming online in terms of trying to staff adequately, as well as it created some fairly significant pressure on the regulators on just trying to keep up with the need to increase the number of folks they have to go out and monitor care issues and other issues and fulfill their responsibility and obligation under the law to assure that we're maintaining high-quality care and services throughout the long-term care setting. And I think you've all got copies of the testimony up there now, and I'd call to your attention the first chart that I have here that shows you really the growth curve on assisted living residential care facilities during that 10-year period, and it tracks the number of licensed beds or units. And as you can see, leading up to that red line there, or that line, which is July 2001, you had a very steep growth curve. And then as you saw, once the moratorium was enacted, that has flattened out considerably. I think the next chart was actually the one when I actually charted out the data was most surprising to me, which was Medicaid caseload growth in the publicly funded portion of these services has leveled off fairly dramatically since the enactment of the moratorium in 2001. One of the objectives of the legislation was to help kind of constrain the caseload in the Medicaid program. And I think, you know, not to mix bills, but I sat through Mr. Piper's testimony on Certificate of Need here in this committee a couple weeks ago, and he talked about that phenomenon in healthcare, how when you increase supply, sometimes you can increase demand. And, you know, we've kind of used that phrase within the long-term care senior housing community on if you build it, they will come. And I think we saw to a significant extent with assisted living and residential care, because it was such a popular care option with consumers, that as these facilities were coming online, we did see, as you can see on that chart, in that period of time between 95 and 2001, we saw significant growth in your Medicaid caseloads, which have leveled off significantly since we have had the moratorium in place. And so I think that does show you in terms of there has been some clear differences prior to the moratorium and post. Now, Senate Bill 510 did not, because of the pipeline issue at the time, or excuse me, the moratorium at the time it was enacted, not completely shut down increased supply in the market, because it has allowed for planned growth. And Senate Bill 510 would still provide for some fairly limited growth in this market. It addresses the issue of pending projects that were grandfathered in originally by essentially giving them the next 24 months after enactment of this to pay an annual registration fee to keep those plans alive. But if at the end of that next 24-month period they've not pulled construction permits and other necessary permits to go ahead with the project, and understand this is 6 years into the moratorium, not if they have still not gone forward with this project, at that point the plans would be considered withdrawn under this law. We had 70 residential care facilities and 79 assisted living facility communities file plans that were grandfathered in under the original moratorium. Since that time, 23 of the assisted living communities were actually built and 35 residential care facilities were built and licensed. And so out of that, that much larger number of almost 150 projects, you've seen, you know, 58 actually come online. And so in our conversations with kind of partner agencies leading up to this session, Oregon Housing Community Services, Senior with People with Disabilities, we had identified that pipeline issue as an issue we wanted to try to address with this legislation to try to get that out. even with the passage of Senate Bill 510, I think a concern a lot of legislators and others have is we've got a tremendous growing population here. Will we have access? Will we be impeding access? If you look at this next chart here where I show you current occupancy rates in Oregon for assisted living residential care facilities, as well as in the distinct part Alzheimer's endorsed units, because a lot of Alzheimer's care is provided in these services, you'll see that they are well under 90% in all three of those distinct categories based on data that was collected in January and February as part of a study looking at this issue. As well, the law, the original law, which would not be amended by this bill, still allows DHS to grant exceptions in very specific cases where you have either a service area or a target population that is underserved and that meets certain criteria. So while this is a pretty strict moratorium in that sense, if you had a rural community that was underserved or a distinct population that was underserved in a service area, whether that distinct population were low-income Medicaid clients, whether they were Alzheimer's or some distinct population, DHS does have the authority under the existing law to grant exceptions that meet that criteria. And so I think we did a pretty careful job with the original legislation to make sure that we allowed for kind of what I'll call a safety valve on that. In closing, what I would say is that we believe that Senate Bill 510 will help provide further stability to Oregon's long-term care delivery system. It will help contain costs in our publicly funded programs and preserve access to vital services that are popular with older Oregonians. With that, I'll stop, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Any questions? I can relate to this very much. My father's in a residential facility, and they had plans to build an assisted living, an Alzheimer's unit, and has been on hold for a while, but still raising money, and mm-hmm. be curious to see what happens. Mr. Berkovian?
Thank you, Chair. Jim, your chart might have shown that. With the moratorium in place, do we know, and maybe this is a question for DHS, are we seeing a shortage at all or of providers coming out or builders for specialized populations like Alzheimer's, or are enough applications being received to, you know, meet those?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Mr. Berkovian, looking specifically at the Alzheimer's population, we have not had or been aware of access issues, generally speaking there. We had a lot of development of Alzheimer's special care facilities during that period of time prior to the moratorium, and a number of the projects that are currently in the pipeline, so to speak, are Alzheimer's units. A lot of times what you will see happen is they will develop a large, let's say, you know, 70, 80, 90 unit assisted living facility, and then they will have a 15 unit Alzheimer's special care unit that will then be licensed as residential care facility. And the distinction there and why they would license the Alzheimer's care facility as RCF as opposed to assisted living is assisted living is required to have a private apartment-like unit with a small kitchenette, a private bathroom, and to promote that independence and dignity for the older individual. In an RCF unit where you're not required to have that kitchenette and some of those other things, it's actually a safer environment for someone with Alzheimer's or dementia. A kitchenette with a microwave and a burner can be a very dangerous thing to have in a unit for someone with Alzheimer's or severe dementia. And so oftentimes you may have a facility that's licensed RCF for the Alzheimer's unit and licensed assisted living for, you know, the non-Alzheimer's dementia population they serve as well. And so we have not run into any of those problems yet, and in the pipeline we do have significant additional Alzheimer's capacity that is, you know, potentially able to come on board at some point.
So, Senator Morrissey.
Thank you. You talked about something that sounded like a certificate of need. Is did they go through the regular certificate of need process?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Moore said at the time back in 2001 when the original moratorium was enacted, we had discussions about do you go to a full-fledged certificate of need process for assisted living residential care, or do you try to just, you know, bring down a moratorium? And looking at states, when hearkening back to Mr. Piper's testimony again, looking around the country as he was looking at that, you did have a number of of states like Oregon that have maintained strong certificate of need for skilled nursing facility beds and facilities, but that did go more the moratorium route with assisted living or residential care.
That's not what I'm asking, I don't think. You said that there are exceptions to the program. If there's a need out there, the department can give permission to build. Is that the certificate of need process, or is it simply something less?
Madam Chair, Senator Moore said it's not specifically the certificate of need process. That authority would rest with the Department of Human Services. Senior and People with Disabilities Division, as opposed to the Health Division, who administers the CON.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know. Yeah. Thank you.
And to speak to that, they've been sensitive to areas, underserved areas, new applications, thing, where distance is an issue and things like that. Yeah. So they've been responsive in appropriate ways.
The certificate of need process can be kind of difficult.
Madam Chair, Senator Moore said, it's, you know, depending on how it's structured in different states and everything else, for our long-term care on the nursing facility side, we've worked well with the Oregon Health Division and their administration of it on the nursing homes.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Any further discussion?
Just that, Madam Chair, I would just indicate the Dash 1 amendments are the amendments that are necessary to address the, what I'll call the pipeline issue, the issue on the pending projects. And I believe they're ready to go at this point.
Okay.
So thank you.
Yeah. Okay, I'd like to... You see no further discussion. I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 510, and I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 510.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 510.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 510. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, move Senate Bill 510 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz has moved Senate Bill 510 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
I think we started this in 2001, and the committee, my committee, which we both served on, and it's working well, and I think we just need to continue it.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. Any further discussion? Clerk will call the roll. Roll.
Or the roll.
Or the roll.
Senator Courtney?
Excused.
Senator George?
Excused.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Morissette?
Aye.
And Chair Moss Henderson?
Aye. Motion carries. And Senator Bates, I think, would like to carry this. All right, so we'll have him carry it. All right, I would like to, did I close the work session?
Not yet.
Yeah, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 510, and I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 617. Jim Anderson.
Brief explanation.
And Mr. Rakobian, can you do a brief explanation?
Thank you, Senator. Senate Bill 617 repeals the sunset on the law mandating health insurance coverage for emergency services, declares an operative date effective upon passage, and declares emergency effective upon passage. This basically emanates out of House 642 of the 2003 session, which repealed as of October 4, 2009. Statute that requires all insurers offering health plans to provide coverage without prior authorization for emergency medical screening, stabilization, emergency services. And in statute, emergency services means those health care items and services furnished in an emergency department and all ancillary routinely available emergency departments to the extent they are required for stabilization of the patient. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Rakobian. Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, thank you. Jim Anderson with the Oregon Chapter American College of Emergency Physicians, committee members, and distinguished guests. This is a very simple bill about a very serious subject. A person's ability to take their health care in their own hands, determine if they need emergency services, get those emergency services without the problems that they might see in their own minds hanging over their head from their commercial health insurance. As committee staff outlined the bill, this issue was first put in Oregon statute in 1997, Senate Bill 911. It was amended last session to extend the sunset. We would like to see that sunset removed completely with this Senate bill. Last session, the only reason it wasn't removed was because there was some question in the mind of the health insurers. And we worked during the interim and during the first part of the session to get those concerns alleviated. They have been. There is no opposition to this bill at this point, and we would urge your passage. I would say that there is one point in my written testimony that points up the fact that HIAA is the entity that I worked with last session and I worked with this session.
HIAA is?
The Health Insurance Association of America.
Okay.
And that has changed. There is new representative now. The acronym is AHIP, America's Health Insurance Plans. And Ms. Lise Brown and I work together on this, and we are both in agreement that this bill should pass. And again, I would state there is no opposition.
Okay. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, Jim. What changed? What changed between then and now to make that? And I don't know that it was necessarily opposition last time. It's just concerns.
It was a concern. Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz. The concern was mandates, and this certainly is. I won't back away from it. This is a mandate in Oregon statute. Certain mandates are good. Certain mandates are questionable. This one was thrown into the large bucket of all health care mandates. That was a question that needed to be addressed and answered during the interim. We had hit and miss communications during the interim, I will admit, but Ms. Brown stepped forward, thankfully, and helped our organization on this issue to come to some resolution, and I think we found that resolution.
Okay. Any other further?
How long has this been on the books?
Since 1997.
97, right. You said that. I'm sorry. Okay.
Okay. No further discussion? No one else to testify? Ms. Brown? Okay. I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 617, and I would like to open a work session on Senate Bill 617.
Madam Chair.
Senator Cruz, wow.
Blowing me away that I'm doing this, but I move Senate Bill 617 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz has moved Senate Bill 617 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
I must be.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I think this is a great bill, and I'm really pleased that we have a unanimous consent up here, and I hope that Senator Cruz gets an opportunity to carry this bill.
Let's not push it.
No, we won't push it. Okay, any further discussion? Will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Courtney?
Excuse.
Senator George?
Excuse.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Marcel?
Aye. Enthusiastically.
Aye. Motion carries. And Senator Courtney will carry this bill. And I close the work session on Senate Bill 617, and I would now like to open a, and thank you, Corey, for being with us. Hopefully you learned a lot. Okay, bye-bye.
You bet. Have a good day.
I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 819, and I'd like to call Tim Nesbitt of the Oregon AFL-CIO. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tim Nesbitt, president of the Oregon AFL-CIO, and I'm here today to speak on behalf of Oregon union members and Oregon taxpayers in favor of Senate Bill 819. This bill is designed to allow for the state to gather and report information on workers who have a job but don't have health insurance. About 60% of Oregonians of all ages, adults, seniors, children, get their health insurance from employment-based get their health care from employment-based health insurance policies. And of those working, more than 80% do. And we certainly applaud those employers who provide good health insurance for their workers, and of course it's a continuing struggle to keep those costs under control. And one aspect of cost control is the cost shifting that occurs when workers and others who don't have health insurance end up either on the public taxpayer-funded health plans, like the Oregon Health Plan, or showing up in hospitals to receive uncompensated care, all of which is a way of shifting costs to us as taxpayers and to those who are insured. We note that two-thirds of Oregon's uninsured working people do have jobs. It's just that those jobs don't provide health insurance. And this means, again, that when they or their children need health care, they often end up on taxpayer-supported programs or, again, showing up in hospitals and receiving uncompensated care. But we don't know much more about the problem than that. And that's what Senate Bill 819 is all about. It will allow us to finally estimate the burden of cost shifting that occurs when profitable employers don't provide health insurance and health care to their workers. We think this is particularly prevalent in the retail sector, where we have many non-union employers who pay wages low enough for people to qualify for public health care. They're profitable companies, and unfortunately, very often, if they do offer health insurance, they have such eligibility requirements that are so stringent that more than half their workers can't afford to sign up or aren't eligible to sign up because they work too few hours. Now, we know from looking at other states that this is a widespread problem. Just last week, the state of Connecticut reported that taxpayers pay up to $72 million annually to cover health care costs for low-wage workers and their children who qualify for taxpayer-supported plans in that state. And the employers at the top of that list were Walmart, Stop and Shop, supermarkets, and Dunkin' Donuts as well. So all kinds of retailers, but again, profitable corporations who end up shifting costs to good employers and to taxpayers. In Iowa, it was more of the same. Hundreds of people are turning to the state health plan because their employers fail to provide coverage. In Georgia, more than 10,000 children of Walmart employees were found to be enrolled in the state public health insurance program called Peach Care, according to a 2002 state report. And the company's failure to cover these children costs both the federal and state entities an estimated $6.6 million. Across the border in Washington State, Walmart has been documented to have the largest number of employees' children enrolled in Medicaid, according to an examination of records in July of 2002. There's no reason to think that Oregon taxpayers aren't carrying the burden for these corporations in the same way here in Oregon. But we don't know and won't know exactly the extent of this problem and the cost to taxpayers and to the insured population and to employers who are making their best effort to maintain health insurance until we can get the kind of data that Senate Bill 819 is designed to collect. Now, I anticipate you're going to be hearing testimony following mine that expresses concern about cost. We know this kind of data collection system can work and works cost effectively in other states, so that there's a concern that you're going to hear about this being prohibitively expensive. We would like the opportunity, and I think Senator Bates is going to help us with this, to find a way to get this aligned with programs done in other states which have proven to be cost effective and have highlighted the extent of this problem. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morissette.
Yeah. Tim, there are two fairly large employee-owned, quote-unquote, corporations in Oregon, one a grocery chain and the other a hardware home shopping chain. Have you investigated, did you look at those in terms of the level of wages? Is that...
Senator, if you're referring to Bi-Mart, which I think is now employee-owned?
Bi-Mart and Winco.
And Winco. I do know that Winco has has represented employees in their warehouses, and they get good health insurance. We know that because they're under a Teamsters contract. Okay. I'm not familiar with the situation at Bi-Mart, but again, this is not about whether you're a unionized employer or not. It's about whether you're providing good health care, and we would hope that in the Bi-Mart situation, they do.
Okay. Follow up. I wasn't... I'm trying not to name them, but no. I think the employee-owned businesses are an alternative to either selling to a larger corporation from the outside, and hopefully the goal is to provide employees who have been there for a certain period of time with significant benefits. They're not always what they seem to be, but I'm hoping that's what they both are.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Senator Bates? By the way, you're carrying a bill that we passed out.
Yeah.
Hope it's one I know about.
No.
It's your bill.
Oh, I hope. I never know with you people. For the record, Senator Alan Bates, I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you real quickly here about this bill. And I didn't have a chance to hear Mr. Nesbitt's entire testimony, so if I repeat something he said, I apologize for that. But let me move forward. The Oregon Health Plan, the Medicaid plan in the state, has some unique characteristics to it, one of which is, and one of the ones we tried to put into it really initially, was that you go to work and not lose your health care benefits. We used to have a situation in the state where people would avoid going to work in order to keep the health care benefits. The health plan has taken care of that for a great deal of them. Unfortunately, that effort can be twisted in a way that large corporations especially can take advantage of it. They can take advantage of it by denying health care benefits to their employees or their employees' dependents. And you find situations occurring in other states, and I assume it probably is occurring in this state, in which a corporation such as Costco, which offers excellent benefits to its employees and works hard to maintain those benefits and has to put that at its bottom line, which is not insubstantial in this day and age, is competing directly with others, such as, I won't mention this point, that would possibly be in a situation where they are not offering those employee benefits and instead utilizing the Oregon Health Plan by either holding down the wages of their employees or not giving them full hours to work, but otherwise qualifying for that. And we know that in some other states, some of these organizations have actually had the paperwork and forms ready and have encouraged those employees to apply for Medicaid benefits while they're working for that corporation or those corporations. This particular bill is one which we want to gather information. We want to find out if these practices are going on in Oregon, and if so, then we can target those companies with either HELP, the form of the FEOP program, or programs like FEOP, or end the practice. Either one would be beneficial to the state. And we really don't want to be in the position where the Oregon Health Plan is being used to subsidize businesses and put them in a competitive situation with other businesses that's unfair. And I have a great fear that is going on. In the bill itself, there is one issue which I'm a little concerned about, and that is the number of employees that would be involved. We're not trying to hurt small employees who really can't afford to maintain expensive health plans. We're aiming at large employers. And if that needs to be changed, or if the cost of gathering information for a number of small employees, 25 or a number just above it, is too expensive, that's something we can look at. I also would like to point out that if there is a significant cost for gathering this information, we have to balance that against the potential savings for the Oregon Health Plan and disenrolling people and getting it into private health insurance, either through FEOP or other programs. So as this bill moves forward and those discussions come forward, I hope you keep those issues in mind. And we might find ourselves looking at a cost of this program, which would be substantial, but at the same time, you have to put that in a concept of what does this do for the Oregon Health Plan, where do we save money there, how can we help these employers get their people into the commercial market, stop this thing we call cost shift, which most of you are already aware of, and get these people, the individuals, properly insured through commercial insurance wherever possible. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Morissette.
Thank you, Madam Chair. 25 employees or employees.
The bill presently reads 25 employees or more, and I'm a little concerned that might be too low a number, but it's something we can look at. I'm really looking at large, from my point of view, I'm looking at larger corporations that have had a practice across the United States of utilizing Medicaid plans in order to shift the health care cost off of their company onto the public domain.
Yes, yeah. Senator Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if there's an additional criteria that could be established for numbers of, well, for the types of employers. A chain, for instance, rather than a locally owned single company. Just some thoughts, because I'm trying to anticipate some of the concerns that people will have when they wondering if they're going to be.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, when I think of chains, I think of the Walmarts of the world, obviously, in this conversation, but there are others out there that would qualify for this. But I think that a certain size in a corporation, whether it's locally owned or a chain, you get into a situation where your revenue is large enough and your pool of employees is large enough that your health care costs go down. And I'm not an expert at that part, but I know that there's a golden number around 100 that is where your costs start to be spread better and you get better rates for your individuals in your company. That's something we could discuss further as far as this bill is concerned, where the number should be, but still go forward with the study. It's one of those situations where you don't know the answer because you haven't asked the question, and the question and how you phrase the question could be very important.
Do we know how many are on Oregon Health Plan that are working? I would think that maybe they would have those numbers. There are those that are working and those who are not on the Oregon Health Plan.
Madam Chair, I do not know the answer to that question at this moment, and my sense is that it's a fairly large number
that are working
either part-time or full-time, but I cannot answer that question. I understand that a large number of individuals on the Oregon Health Plan are children, and probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 or 40%, possibly higher, are children. I wouldn't expect them to be working, even in these tough, difficult times.
I was thinking...
That's a joke, Madam Chair.
Ha-ha.
Okay. Jeez.
Position humor.
I was just wondering if in the Medicaid process if they actually list where they work or if they just say they're working.
My understanding, this is one of the problems of asking the question we're trying to ask, is why I think they probably track incomes, obviously, and infer from that that they're working. I don't think they ask the question of where you work.
But they have to prove with pay stubs in order to be eligible, and you see the pay stub and you can see where they work.
My expectation is these W-2 forms or pay stubs if they're on a six-month program. It's information that can be garnered, and that information may be available as far as working. What I don't think they have available to them at this point, and that's been indicated to us, is they don't know where they work. They don't know their employer.
Senator Cruz.
Do you have any data from the Georgia program?
Any data from the
Georgia program? Georgia instituted a program called Georgia Peach, which was designed to get at this. And, I mean, if you're going in a direction, it would be interesting to see some data from states that have already attempted something like this to see what sort of results they've gotten.
There's three or four states that have done this. I believe Georgia has, and I think Iowa has, and they found the same practices going on in all the states with specific... with specific companies especially noted for using Medicaid plans inside their companies, and Walmart being sort of the poster child for it.
Madam Chair, I guess the point being, if we're going to consider something like this, and there's some concerns with various aspects of this at this point, but it would be interesting. I think it'd be informative to see what states that several years ago, I believe, attempted to find remedies, see what experience they have had.
Madam Chair, I think that I agree with Senator Cruz. The first question you've asked ask yourself, are those practices going on in the state? If in fact they are, then you can look for remedies for them. We're a rather unique state. We have the FIAP program, which is the one I would love to see these people get involved in. We actually have funds there available for that program, and we're looking for group employers. So, you know, it's a matter of finding these corporations and then saying, what can we do to make this work better for everybody?
Thank you. Senator Westlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Senator Ben Westlin, District 27, Central Oregon. I'm here to testify in support of the bill. Let me just jump right in and be blunt. There is a cost to not having health insurance at any level. And there is a subsidy that goes on that we all pay, and we all willingly pay. And many of us that utilize, and I am first in line to pay the lowest price and obtain for myself the best value in a service or product that I possibly can. It's the American way. But we have got to recognize that there is a cost to that, not only in dollars, but also a cost in terms of our quality of life and our overall wellness, not only in this state, but in this nation. So I would strongly urge your favorable consideration of not only this bill, but this concept. And with regard to Senator Cruz's comment relating to Georgia, I think we'd be able to get some of that data for you, but as long as we're going to Georgia and maybe to cross-pollinate a little bit here, I think we should also look at some of the very excellent work that Georgia has done on their Certificate of Need program as well.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Okay. Thank you, Senators.
Thank you.
I assume, if I may, that this is an additional one of the bills that Senator Cruz and I are collaborating on, and this is one of the but we didn't get you on this one?
Bates Senator is Bates is all by himself on this one. That's why I'm wondering why in the world you're even here.
I'm automatically testifying to the bills without realizing it, okay?
Senator Westland's been testifying on virtually every bill in all committees for the last 2 weeks, so I'm not sure what's going on there.
Well, I'd say there's probably a focus on those. It's all health care. And that is why I'm so pleased at the warm welcome and reception that this gracious committee has provided me.
Okay, Patty O'Sullivan and J.L. Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senators.
Thank you, Senators.
And Lisa Tressel. You're not on the list, Lisa.
Good afternoon.
Okay.
My name is Patty O'Sullivan. I'm the Legislative Director for the Department of Human Services, and I'm here to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 819 as written. Unless you want to go into detail, it has a very large fiscal impact, and as written, it is going to be very, very difficult to implement. The Employment Department has given us information that they cannot share their information with us. We sort of looked at how you could...
Who can?
The Employment Department.
Oh, okay.
We tried to look at how we could actually make this work if we ended up having to do it. And they are disallowed by law from sharing their information, so we can't get employer data from them either through Social Security numbers of our clients or through employer names. There's additional problems with the way that the bill is currently written. However, we did promise Senator Bates that we would sit down with him after this hearing and look at how we might come up with some language or something to make it work. Right now, the estimated fiscal impact is about $5 million a year, but that's lots of staff to ask lots of questions and dig into lots of employers' information that we can't get from the Employment Department, so it went sky high after that. If you'd like to ask any questions?
Well, what about the information that OMAP already has?
Chair Melissa Anderson, OMAP asks if you're working. And sometimes they voluntarily say, yeah, I work at whatever, 7-Eleven, and they ask if they have health insurance or if the employer provides it. That information is just currently written on an application. It's not captured in a database anywhere. And so now you're talking about capturing it and making sure that the questions are answered. And then capturing it and then trying to run it down. I mean, maybe they don't know the corporation name of where they work. It's just a DBA. There's a lot of information that has to go into finding who the true employer. I mean, when you say Walmart, you say Walmart, everybody knows that. But there's lots of other employers that it's more difficult to garner that information.
Who would be the contact then at OMAP just to get clarification on what they store in the database, since I assume the applications are put into a database? Would that be Barney?
Chairman Sanderson, I can get you that information.
Yeah.
I picked the short straw today to come here, so
okay.
I'll go back
okay.
and get the information.
It would be nice to just see if it is in the database and if it's easily captured. If it's not, it's not, you know.
Chairman Sanderson, I know that it is not captured.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Questions?
Well, no, Madam Chair, I guess I what I'm looking at when I look at the bill and what the intent is, you know, the folks in OHP are already captured and they're already known. That's mm-hmm. not where this focus is. This focus is outside of that and to the fiat population and the potential fiat population and getting those numbers. Is not something that DHS currently has. And so that's where some of this problem would be.
And I would like to add that we're a little bit concerned about some of the HIPAA requirements as well. If you publish information, people might be able to identify clients of ours through that information. And we're a little bit concerned about that as well. But we did say we'd sit down with Senator Bates and talk about it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
J.L. Wilson.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, J.L. Wilson representing NFIB. I've got 12,000 small businesses who are dues-paying members of NFIB Oregon. We would also not be supportive of Senate Bill 819 currently. We're not here to do Walmart's bidding. Walmart can defend themselves. I don't represent them. But I'm here to affirm the good doctor's assertion that the threshold of 25 employees or higher is much too low. As you know, Madam Chairwoman, we worked on a bill last session that expanded coverage or offered a basic level of coverage to those employers in the small group market, which is 2 to 50 employees. And the purpose of that bill was to give them an avenue to purchase coverage because the cost of coverage is just far exceeding their ability to pay for it. I mean, our last survey this year, fewer than 20% of our members were able to keep their cost increases under 10%, which means 80% had a cost increase in excess of 10%. And that's significant because that's played itself out year after year after year. In fact, we've had 70% of our members at our peak offer health coverage to employees, and this was about 6 years ago, and now we're down to 59%. Now, I think we bottomed out, but the cost increases have been significant, and it's played itself out in our market. Now, I can't see any relevant use for this information, at least as stipulated in the bill, other than just to stigmatize those employers. And I don't want to be a part of something where you're stigmatizing an employer just by virtue of the fact that they flat out can't afford health insurance coverage. And so I would like to see the employer or the employee threshold moved up significantly in this bill because I think it's very intrusive to small companies. And I'll touch on the FEOP subject too. I know some of my employers do participate in FEOP. They would be reluctant to say that they do, but I think if you value FEOP as a relevant product and one that's has some discernible value, you know, this bill would give me pause because I don't think you want to discourage employers from any way in participating in FEOP. In fact, I think you want to encourage it. And to make a small employer in that small group market, 2 to 50, have to disclose that, I think it could be a bit of a discouragement. And so I would just warn you of those two items.
Questions? Thank you, J.L. Lisa.
Can I move the mic?
I know there's a sign, but...
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm here also in support, in opposition of Senate Bill 819. Oops, get my words confused. And a couple of things that concern us about this bill is that we're not sure what's the useful purpose of the information. And Mr. Wilson touched on some of the points. You know, maybe it's to publicly humiliate or embarrass individual companies, but there's a lot of reasons why an employer who, if you want to use a larger employer as an example, has employees that might be getting public subsidy on their health insurance. Sometimes you bring in temporary workers to fill positions for people who are off on family leave of absence, for example. And you have to keep the job open because the employee who's going to return has the right to that job, and typically you're not going to pay the benefits on that temporary worker. Another reason might be it's a seasonal group of workers who may be subject to a collective bargaining agreement where the collective bargaining agreement says you have to work X number of hours a year before you're eligible for coverage. So the employer may offer it, but they may have workers that are lower paid workers that find their way into the FEOP program or something along those lines. And then the last thing is it doesn't tell you anything about sporadic work history. You have a certain population of workers that move from job to job, and so it could be the same worker with multiple employers showing up. So the fact that we're collecting the data on who are the employers that have employees getting subsidies, and do they have health insurance, and how much do the employers pay towards that, that doesn't give enough information to make a decision on. And again, we agree with NFIB on the fact that if this is the approach you take, it will have, I think, impacts on the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, FEHIP, because why would you encourage workers right now to look at that as a way to help supplement what the employer can pay towards their insurance if you're going to be put up on a website and subject to ridicule or something. So for those reasons, we have concerns about the bill. And I thank you for your time.
Great. Yeah. Madam Chair, that was I agree that was a poison pill. I just noticed as it's going to be a disincentive for employers to want to access FEOP and quite simply for that reason. And we have been over the last couple sessions doing everything we can to try to get information out about FEOP and get people to sign up. It's a great program that needs to be expanded, and I'd hate to see us doing something that would be a drag on that access. And clearly, I think this would be.
Okay. Yes, Senator Morissette.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I don't want to second guess the author of the bill, but I think it has to be much more specific to the employer that he has in mind. And I too was concerned about the number and the type. I that all has to be clarified, I think. And you may not even agree with the intent of the focusing on a particular company. That's a different issue. But I think the way it's written is much too vague, and I agree with you in that matter.
Okay. No further discussion? Anyone in the back want to speak on this? Okay, I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 819 and meeting's adjourned.